good afternoon and welcome to the second meeting of the Performance Review and Scrutiny Committee. We have apologies from Councillor Montgomery, Young, Imrie, Beattie and Baxter. Are there any other apologies? Okay. Order of business as per the agenda. Any declarations of interest can be made throughout the meeting. Moving on to 4.1, Commercial Operations Performance Report in Quarter 4. Ricky?
Thanks, Chair. I'll go through some of the kind of main points in the first couple of pages and then happy to take any questions from members thereafter. In terms of waste, I've mentioned there that the food waste plant at Miller Hill was due to accept commissioning. We've actually moved on now, and the plant is now due to start collecting Midlothian's food waste from next Monday, the 13th, so we'll start delivering direct to Miller Hill. In terms of food waste, there's quite a good news story. Once again, Midlothian residents have exceeded expectations, and those expectations were modelled on some of the better performers around Scotland, but we are certainly up there and in fact almost leading it. At this moment in time, we've now collected just over 1,200 tonnes of food waste for recycling, well on the way to that 2,000 tonnes there that we anticipate. And kind of jumping slightly, I mentioned the annual recycling rate for 2015 was confirmed at just under 48%. The higher than anticipated food waste recycling rate, should it continue as we envisage, then we're likely to see a recycling rate in 2016 of approximately 53%. Moving back, in terms of the residual waste plant at Miller Hill, the last stage before we actually start full construction is financial close, i.e. signing the deal with FCC, and we're now anticipating that to take place during July. I do mention there that pre-construction works are actually taking place at this point in time, and that will allow full construction to take place thereafter. In terms of the road network, I mentioned there about the significant work that's been done in the footway projects around Midlothian. There's quite a considerable amount of footworks have been improved. In terms of the road network, we've just had the latest figures for the condition of the network, and essentially that suggests that the network hasn't deteriorated over the last 12 months. But it is worth pointing out there that the very wet December did lead to a number of areas, and they wouldn't have been included within that latest survey figure. So it's just kind of making members aware of that. Moving down to Borders Rail, it's fair to say that the number of passengers has exceeded the predicted numbers, albeit within Midlothian, we are slightly below where we anticipated. In terms of land and countryside, there's a number of significant projects that have been completed across Midlothian, primarily at schools. We've worked closely with schools, and these are kind of proven beneficial. A lot of things like trim trails, etc., which are great in terms of the youngsters and getting out to keep fit. Moving on, in terms of the green flags, members will be aware we've already got four green flags, and that's essentially a measure of the quality of what's available at those parks. And this year we're hoping to secure a fifth green flag following the works that we've done in Memorial Park at Lone Head. In terms of, I suppose, partly addressing some of the budget issues, but it's also about utilising the skills in both land and countryside and road services. We've amalgamated some of the teams there and we're securing external contracts. I mentioned there two contracts with a combined value of £50,000. But we've actually got quite a challenging target for the year, and we're making good progress in terms of bringing that income into the council. The last point in terms of kind of progress where we are, I mentioned there about the electric charging points that have been installed, and we've got fruitful discussions ongoing with City Car Club, who are keen to see vehicles brought in and around Midlothian, initially in Dalkeith, and that's with a view to siting these vehicles that will be made available for general public, but also the potential to have a deal for our own employees to kind of encourage them to use these vehicles more often. In terms of some of the emerging challenges, I mentioned in the first one there about the processing of the blue bin material, and that is still very much a live issue for us. Discussions are still ongoing with Viridor, and at this moment in time, we don't have an agreed position going forward. But as I say, those discussions are taking place. What I don't mention there, and it's an issue that has just become live today, members will be aware in terms of a residual waste. We currently have a contract with NES, New Earth Solutions, to dispose of our residual waste. If anybody is aware of the kind of waste press, NES have gone into liquidation. However, we do have agreements that we're trying to put in place with the subsidiary who take that waste and process it, and we're looking to deal with them directly in the short term. What we would also look to do is potentially this May, in the short term, give us an option to discuss with Viridor. However, that's something that we need to look at, but we're hoping that that may indeed be a positive in terms of potential budget pressures that these situations may have given. I mentioned there in terms of the work that's going on with decriminalised parking, we're now into the second stage, which is about agreeing a robust business case to present to Transport Scotland. There is kind of a slightly moving feast on that one, in terms of what's required, but we're still confident that we can take something forward subject to council agreement in due course that allow us to bring in decriminalised parking early in 2017. And just touching on very briefly about the road maintenance budget, that there is pressure there, and as I say, whilst we have managed to maintain the network, the impact of last December weather can be underestimated. And the last thing to bring to members' attention is just an ongoing concern about Iron Mills steps, which go from Cemetery Road down to Iron Mills Park, and there is a continuing land slip there, and we will be bringing a report to Council at the end of June with some options there to address that issue. Chair, I'll pause at that point for any questions.
Thanks, Ricky. Questions, comments? Brian.
Thank you. I've got a few points. I'll just raise them all at once if you want. But I did attend the food recycling waste visit on the 15th of April, and I found it very, very interesting. What I couldn't get my head around was the contracts, you know, and different people have got different contracts and subcontractors to subcontractors, and all I wanted to get in was, you know, how much of this is going to be beneficial financially to Midlothian Council, and maybe that could be provided offline if you want, or give me some kind of idea. The same kind of idea that if we go from 48% recycling to 53%, what does it mean per percentage point, roughly, how much more are we benefiting from that? I know a lot of the things we do with penalties and different clauses and contracts again as well, but you know, there must be some kind of equation there where that the more we recycle, the more we're saving, and the more our budgets are going to be more favourable. On the roads network, you talk about many areas for pavements. I'm just wondering if you're going to do any consultation on that. I thought, you know, even if the community councils were aware that they were going to do some pavements up, they might give you a priority list. And their areas that they think that was the most important to it. Borders Rail, on the point on the signage, shall we say, at the stations, Newton Grange is still signposted wrongly on the map at the site, and I wonder if there's information boards, I was told, that was coming with leaflet dispensers on them, and that would include things like the hop-on, hop-off bus. I just wonder if you could keep me informed of the progress, the new signage and the new displays of signs for Borders Rail, because people need to know where they are when they get off the train and where they're going to, you know, and how they're going to go and where they're going to go. The Penicuik Community Recycling Centre, you talked about the difficulties in refurbishment. So the risk of the refurbishment is listed, but is the risk of the depot at all in the considerations? And my final point, Chair, on the on page 5 of 120, when we talk about the carbon footprint, if you want, and the reduced the travel to work kind of costs and the various surveys and work we've done on that, are we proposing to also do the repositioning of the council depot from Newton Grange to Bonnerig, and the staff carbon footprint of their travel to work kind of agendas, could that also be included in the report, the reports that we're doing on these items?
Thanks, Councillor. I'll go through these and hopefully I've noted them all and I'll pick them up. In terms of the various contracts, we have three main, four main waste streams. We have garden waste, which goes to Force Resource. That we have recycling, which goes to Viridor. We have food waste, which will go to ARE. And we have residual waste, which eventually will go to FCC. In terms of the difference between food waste and general residual, approximately we spend about £40 a tonne to reprocess our food waste. The residual waste, because of the high figures for landfill tax, were in excess of £100. So we have over £60 a tonne swing for every tonne that we send to food waste. And similarly, currently in terms of recycle it, again, currently the contracted price is around about £20 a tonne for a recycle it. So again, every tonne that we can recycle through the Viridor contract, there's a significant saving. And that's why we kind of continue to spend a lot of efforts to encourage people to do that. In terms of the road network, you should be aware that all the various decisions that we make in relation to the road network are based on asset management principles. So it's essentially what are the busiest footways, what are the ones that are requiring attention to kind of minimise the cost going forward. But we also did notify each of the community councils, so if there was feedback, then we would take that on board. In terms of the Newton Grange station, the interactive signs are all in place. So if somebody wants to, for example, get up-to-date travel information or information relating to attractions, they can use these signs and all that information is there. What we also did very recently is we did an audit of signage from the stations. So not necessarily into the stations, but from the stations where people might want to go. So there's a series of actions there that we're putting in place. And in terms of the fleet mileage, what I would simply say there is that there's nothing off the table in terms of what we'd hope to come forward with. The latest piece of work that the graduate's done is looking at the fleet utilisation. So these vehicles, where are they going? Is there duplication of routes? Are we utilising all the vehicles? Is there some that we are underutilising and perhaps we can reduce? That's one strand. But what I would say is it's a kind of all-encompassing project and there will be a series of things. So you mentioned about the depot. All I would say is at this time, nothing's off the table in terms of what we'll come forward with and what we would hope to reduce in terms of changing our carbon footprint.
Hi, Ricky, a couple of issues. I notice in here that we're slightly off target. On page 11 of 120, we're slightly off target in terms of uplifting abandoned vehicles. I'm just wondering, you know, how we're dealing with this at the moment. I've had personal experience of vehicles being outside my property for months, Now, I realise there are complications in terms of the legal situation, the police getting involved and things like that, but vehicles that are quite clearly no roadworthy, lights smashed, you know, and left lying in the street for months. I've been told by a constituent that the very park that we, as mentioned right at the beginning of your contribution here, had a vehicle in it which clearly isn't appropriate and it shouldn't have been there. And residents were asking both the council and the police to have it removed for fear that somebody would end up setting fire to it. And that happened at the weekend. It was set alight. So we now have a burned out vehicle in the park that we've spent some considerable time getting knocked into shape. That is the park next to Ballinow Lane. But you know, what is the situation with the abandoned vehicles, and what are the difficulties? And if it's difficulties between us and the police, you know, as partners, what are we doing to try and streamline that process? The other issue is fly tipping. I've had a look at, I can't see anything in here that, do we collect information separately on how much it costs us to deal with the fly tipping? Because it's anecdotal. I'm just, again, from my own experience, I've noticed a significant increase in the fly tipping around Carrington and places like that. And it's no, you know, like a lawnmower box or something like that full of rubbish that's chucked out that you occasionally see. We're talking about vehicles. We're talking about sizeable lorries going up there and basically just tipping into the side of the road or into the entrance to fields, or, unfortunately for the farmers, in the fields, which means that we can't uplift it. Is there, you know, can you see a significant increase in that sort of activity going on at the moment? And do we collect information as to how much that's costing us?
Yeah, thanks, Councillor. In terms of abandoned vehicles, the process that we have followed is that if an abandoned vehicle is identified, or a vehicle that's considered abandoned, we will look at it. The first thing that we would do is check ownership. Now, what I would say is over the last 6 months, we've had an issue with that because we used to have a direct link with the DVLA that would allow us to check ownership of vehicles, and that, for a variety of reasons, has not been available to us. We've tried to utilise information from the police, but that has caused a slight issue. What would happen is we look at the vehicle. If it clearly looks as though it's abandoned, we can't find the owner and have them remove it, then we sticker it and we give a period of time when it would be taken away. One of the very, very strange things that's happened over the last 2 or 3 months, and it has had an impact, is that the metal companies that would normally take abandoned vehicles are no longer wanting them. There's no scrap value, so there is a significant cost if you can actually get a contractor to take them. So that is an issue. In terms of the one at Ballinow, it's not one that I'm aware of, but I will take it away and I'll come back to you on that one specifically. In terms of fly tipping, what we do is we map every location of fly tipping. There is it's a national database, Fly Mapper, and what that does is we record where the fly tipping is, when it is, and what the material is, and essentially most of it is disposed of in terms of residual waste rather than recycle it. Now, what we don't have is we don't have an individual cost, but it is something that we can certainly readily put a figure to. The last part that you asked is whether there has been an increase, and yes, I would agree that over certainly the last 6 to 12 months there's been an increase. Trying to put a figure on it, again, I would have to interrogate the database, and I'll come back to you on that just to give you a kind of indication what that is.
Jim, then, Peter.
As far as the abandoned vehicles are concerned, Ricky, there seems to be, you know, there's been a lot of problems. There's been issues, as you say, with the communications, which you've not gone into the detail on. I just wonder if, you know, we're almost, and I'm not accusing you, but it's almost like we're passing the buck. You know, it's always somebody else's, and I'm talking from the point of view of residents that either call into the council or the police. There's a frustration that it doesn't seem to ever be the person that you're talking to's responsibility. Is there nothing that we can do collectively, you know, amongst our partners to try to resolve some of the issues that you've specifically mentioned? And I had, to be honest, I had forgotten about the one you'd said there. You'd already said to me about the issues getting the information off the database. But, you know, surely that needs to be resolved so that we can quickly get these vehicles that shouldn't be on our streets, off our streets, or out of our public parks, and in some instances, as quickly as possible.
No, you're absolutely right, and it's just something that I know Phil Riddell was working on. So what I'll do is I'll take it away from here and I'll give you an update in terms of how we're going to address that.
Peter?
Yeah, wonderful report, Ricky. And Jim raises the issue of fly tipping, and I have to congratulate Midlothian Council, because I travel almost daily past black spots where fly tipping occurs. I then ring either Ricky, or if he's not there, John, and it all gets removed almost instantaneously, often within 24 hours, or by the time that I ring in the morning and return in the afternoon, it's gone. So fantastic, but it is a huge cost to us. And I just wonder, you know, I like the idea of really analysing the costs involved, because the reason that people are fly tipping is that we are charging them for taking it off them. And I wonder whether the cost of collecting the fly tipping is not almost in excess of the cost of the income that we get from accepting. Would it be worth to analyse what the costs are in relation to the income that we get from third parties for accepting their waste?
Thanks for those initial comments, Councillor. In terms of the cost of fly tipping, would it outweigh the cost of dealing with it in terms of the income we would receive? Let's be absolutely clear, any householder can bring their waste to either Stobhill or Pennycook free of charge. There is no charge. What we're talking about here are, I'll describe them as traders. You can maybe have your own interpretation of someone that, for example, does a driveway and then dumps that material that's excavated on one of our roads. The issue here is that if we had any charge, then these people would simply fly tip because they're not interested in paying anything. That's kind of one of the issues. In terms of that kind of cost balance, I would probably reflect on the situation that was within City of Edinburgh Council, and they have recently taken a decision to stop their trade waste. So essentially, it was costing them a significant amount of money. So I would suggest that it is perhaps very difficult. The other thing is that our facilities at the moment are not licensed to accept trade waste. It's only household waste. So there is an issue there to overcome. So in terms of how would we get people to bring that material in, quite frankly, the only way that you would encourage these people to bring it in to a recycling centre is to offer it free of charge. And the minute that you offer a facility free of charge, then the cost of dealing with it, as I've explained to Councillor Pottinger, in excess of £100 a tonne, I can tell you that the cost would rise astronomically in terms of what would be brought into our sites.
Jim?
Just to say that, echoing what Ricky's saying, there can be no excuse or valid reason. You know, the fact that they're going to have to pay to dump the rubbish, they're already charging their customers. When they go and they uplift a drive or they do a house clearance, they're charging their customers for getting rid of the waste. And it would be totally the wrong thing to do for us to consider making it free of charge to try and encourage them. Because you're right, if you charge one penny piece for that service, they won't pay it. They'd rather go and dump it in the middle of nowhere. if there's money to be spent, I think it needs to be spent on catching them doing it, you know. And then, of course, you get into the situation as well, what actually happens to them if they do get caught? And I'm not so sure that the punishment or the you know, damages that they have to pay for that are sufficient to discourage them either. But I would like to see us try to do as much as we can in terms of enforcing and catching the people that are doing this. And on top of that, you know, for a domestic point of view, it's quite frustrating. I find it quite frustrating when I've asked, for instance, that there's a Pwdym O'Brien Gore Bridge, the amount of rubbish that was over the other end of the wall there, and Ricky kindly got guys to come up and clear it up, took a squad of guys 2 days to clear this area up. Now, part of that, when the litter warden or the warden went up to have a look at that, he actually identified some personal information for somebody that lived opposite, and wasn't he able to do anything other than knock the door and tell them to go and clean it up, which they did. But my point of view is I would like to be able to name and shame when that kind of thing happens, because it is totally damaging to the communities in which the people live that do that kind of thing, yet we're not able to name and shame. I know that some councils, I know Manchester experimented with that some years ago, I recall talking about it in this chamber. But I'd like to see us go down that road in terms of naming and shaming, especially, you know, individuals that are fouling their own environments or their own neighbours' environments.
Okay. Brian.
So just to follow up on the questions asked earlier, I didn't think I really got an answer to the Pennycook depot. We talked about the SEPA reports and the noise instances in the report, and we talked about how the redevelopment of it is at risk. But I did ask the question, is the depot then at risk? If we kind of get redeveloped, you know, is there a status quo position that the Pennycook depot will be fine with? And on the Grey Fleet mileage, maybe you didn't fully understand what I was trying to get at, but I really want to know, you know, the travel to work, the people that take their vehicles home with them, you know, the carbon footprint of relocating that site, and I anticipate more demand on people to take their vehicles home. So some kind of survey on that, so we could actually have a carbon footprint report on the implications of realigning the depot.
Yeah, sorry, Councillor, for not picking up that one on Pennycook Depot. I actually had a meeting this morning with colleagues that are considering the application and some of the issues in terms of what would be a hurdle that perhaps is difficult to overcome. And I actually think we've managed to get a solution, and that would then protect both the integrity of the recycling centre and the depot. So I'm anticipating that we've got a way around that, but it's potentially that I may have to come back to council to kind of update them in terms of that. I hate to do it, but in terms of the new depot, my colleague Gary Sherritt here is probably leading on that. So, Gary, if it's not too onerous, perhaps could ask Gary if there's any input in relation to the depot.
In terms of the ongoing consultation for the depot, where we are at the moment, we've had a decision by council about the relocation. We then have to go through consultation and looking at the brief, building up the full brief of what goes into that depot, who's going to be moving from where to where. I think we've covered that within the council report as well, generally, but the details still to follow. We then have to go through the planning application, and that will include all the neighbourhood consultations and the likes. But I think it's incumbent on us. I mean, part of my remit is to look at the carbon plan and report back on that. It's incumbent on us to make sure that we cover all of these topics when we come back with a full report on what the depot will look like in the future, as opposed to the strategic decision that's been taken at this point in time.
Any other questions for Ricky before I come in? Ricky, thank you. Can I take you back to the waste, the food waste and the recycling in general? I think is a major success story for us, and to be quite honest, I think I always thought it would be, because I think the people in Midlothian engaged in recycling right from the very, very start. I think we were quite surprised at how well engaged they were, even in areas where we thought it wouldn't be successful. The question I have really is there any intention chasing up who is using food waste? And I keep in mind here that when we delivered the food waste containers, unfortunately it was one of the days, certainly in Bonnerig, I didn't think about elsewhere, where there was about a 50 to 60 mile an hour wind and half the containers landed away down the bottom of certain streets. So I know quite a few people who haven't got them. When I spoke to them about food waste, they weren't even aware that they had a food waste bin delivered, which was kind of disappointing. I kind of touched on this before about kind of having them pick your fences and stuff like that, and then inundated with complaints that the roses have been crushed when they've actually been put in gardens. Is that possible? Another issue that we actually discussed some years back, some 4 years back I think it was the potential in other waste areas looking at allowing either new twice as many bins on recycling, or indeed the bigger blue bin. And at that time, you weren't in a position to say whether you would have been in favour of that, because as people continue to recycle more and more stuff is available for recycling, we're quite often hearing people saying that their recycling bin's full, it's not big enough. However, their girding's not that big that they want another bin. They would have rather had the option of having a 360 blue bin. And they find it quite strange that while we're trying to encourage recycling, they have the option of a 360-litre normal rubbish bin, and they didn't have the option of a 360 blue recycling bin. And it was to see whether you were intent looking at introducing that. It was also to see, one of the things that we have noticed, I think, is that on bin day there seems to have been a steady growth over the years of the amount of folk with the 360 bins for general rubbish. Is there an intent at one stage you were going out and you were analysing all the folk that had these bins? Are we still doing that? Because it's quite clear now that since we've introduced that many years ago under a strict criteria where you had to actually prove that you were recycling everything you could, the recycling containers can take a lot more additional items that they couldn't take back then. You've had food waste reintroduced and stuff like that. Is there an intention to start now going back over the people who have these large bins and checking that they are actually taking part, which was part of the criteria for getting a larger bin, that you had to prove that you were doing what everybody else was doing? Are we going to go back in and check that? Use supervisors and environmental health officers along that line as well.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. In terms of the food waste generally, yeah, the Waste Aware team are doing two things. They're linking in with the collection teams, but they're also doing their own surveys in terms of where we're actually collecting, and then they're going back to look at some of these areas to see, A, if there is bins, and then secondly, if people are not using the bins, why that is, and kind of door knocking, leafleting, etc., to encourage people to do that. What we have done in terms of blue bins is we've given people a second bin. What I would suggest to you that in terms of that and your last question in relation to the number of people with 360 residual, you'll be aware of the work that we're doing with Zero Waste Scotland, looking at the whole issue of collection frequencies. And from that, there will be part and parcel a review of bins and what we're actually providing, and then how we can encourage people to utilise the blue bin service rather than residual. However, what we do, and again, it's working closely with the crews, is that where there is evidence that either people are not recycling or where there appears to be a change in circumstance in terms of why people would still have a 360, we're going back and reviewing that and removing the 360 and returning the 240.
I'm glad to hear that, Ricky, because I'm now at the point of believing that without exceptional circumstances, for example, two kids on nappies or that in a house, I can't see a circumstance where any normal family would need a 360 bin now with the additional recycling that you can have, and you now have the food waste if you're fully using that. I certainly know one friend of mine who had a 360 and for a genuine reason, now it's going out half empty. Because he has that capacity. He has a big enough back garden to take two blue bins, but there are a lot of folk who didn't. But it's good to know that that work's still continuing, and I think it has been a great success story, so if you could pass on, congratulations to the guys for doing that. Is there any further questions for Ricky? Okay, Ricky, thank you. Can we now move on to 4.2, Finance and Integrated Service Support, Gary Fearley.
Thanks, Chair. Like Ricky, I'll just cover some of the key points from the first couple of pages and then happy to take any questions. As you've heard me say before, I suppose the focus of the team is around the delivering the transformational change in service provision as a means, as a lasting means to secure financial sustainability, while at the same time focusing on the resources that the Council's got on achievement of its strategic priorities. We've got three key programmes, the Review of Local Government Workers' Pay and Condition, which you'll hear more about at Council later this afternoon, the Delivering Excellence Programme and the Financial Strategy. And we've got a number of other work streams listed in the paper there that support that. In terms of the financial position, yes, we had a challenging time going through the budget for the current financial year in the last quarter of last year, but we did address a budget shortfall of £7.6 million with a utilisation of £2.6 million of reserves. We're working now on the closing the accounts for 15-16, and we'll present them to Council in June, and we'll see the final outturn report, and I'm hopeful that will show an improved position from quarter three. We've already turned our attention firmly to the prospects for later years' budgets, and that's going to be one of the big challenges. And by the time we set the budget later in the year, you'll be sick fed up by me talking about the financial challenge. But there's a long way to go and a lot of hard work to do as we move into the preparing for the next round of budgets. And that's going to be the right at the heart of the challenges we face. In terms of addressing that challenge or preparing for it, the team continue to support and indeed deliver a number of transformational changes. We've got the Delivering Excellence Programme, the framework there, and the first phase of external engagement is ongoing, and you'll have seen some of the fantastic communications for that. We're in the process of migrating to a new council website. We did better than some of our neighbours in terms of the rating of the website, and the upgrade that we're doing will allow it to be much more suitable for use on mobile and tablet devices, which is probably like most of the people in the room, the way you access web information these days. So that should be a very positive step forward, and it will create a platform for really getting to a website that is much more transactional. Our legal team's changed beyond recognition over the last couple of years. We're now doing a lot of in-house court work that previously we'd put out to contractors, and that's proven a real success, and the team are engaging with service managers really to avoid court action in the first place and avoid the cost of that. So that's a very positive and you know, very worthwhile exercise. And we continue to support a number of changes and transformational changes and service improvements, and I won't go through them all, but they're listed in the report. There's still more work to do on that to drive the Delivering Excellence Programme and to drive through the Council's Transformation Programme. We've had a number of successes with digital services, and I suppose building on the single digital services team we've put in, we continue to secure PSN compliance. We've developed a new digital strategy, which paves the way for how we will use technology in the future, And we've been doing a lot of good work, particularly around the school estate, and making sure that the infrastructure and the assets are fit for purpose. We've recently signed up to the Swan National contract in terms of network, which will give much more resilience. We're in schools at the moment doing a Wi-Fi audit to make sure we've got the resilience there, so that as kids bring devices along and we use technology to really drive up attainment, that the infrastructure is there to support that. The biggest challenge, I suppose, is how we use digital solutions and technology to really drive change in the way we do business, improving service for our customers, our pupils, and also reducing cost. If I turn to people, with a number of achievements under the people strategy, as I touched on earlier, pay and grading comes to council this afternoon, and that's a big step forward. A number of things hang off the back of that. And at the heart of that, I suppose, is how we support the culture and behavioural shift so that we ensure excellent customer service from all of our employees all of the time. In terms of procurement, Council became an accredited living wage employer in April 2016. We already paid above the living wage for our own directly employed staff, but that means that we've got a plan in place to make sure that all the providers that are working on our all the suppliers working in our premises will have be paying at or above the living wage. So I suppose, just turning to emerging challenges, it will be money in terms of the future year's budget. We'll know we still expect or are assuming there will be a three-year settlement by Scottish Government with their budget set around about September. The timescale of that is maybe just a little bit vague in terms of the impact of the income tax receipts that Government will have. Hopefully a three-year spending review announced in December, and a requirement to set the 17-18 budget by the 11th of March. We want to secure council approval for the pay and grading structure. If that is then approved by the trade unions through a ballot process, then we will be moving and working hard to implement the 1st of October. And as part of that, continue to see a shift in culture and behaviours. We want to look at, we are continuing to look at our own service costs, to look at how we reduce those in light of the financial climate, and also how we improve end-to-end service provision for our customers. And I suppose just finally maintaining security over our digital infrastructure, the assets and the networks, and making sure we've got the right technology to deliver the very best service that our customers expect. Chair, happy to pause there and take any questions you might have.
Questions? Comments? Gary, it's just to see what actions would tend to be taken about. I know we're sitting in the bottom quartile of the rankings of cost per 1,000 population in the area of local government benchmarking. What action do we intend to sort of take to bring us out of there?
Indulge me a moment till I just find that on the document.
I think it's 28, Gary.
Thank you. So is that the central support as a percentage of growth? The ISS review should have an impact on that as we take central costs out, but it'll be on the margins, and I would expect all of our other local authorities are also taking similar costs out. The challenge, I suppose, is in terms of a ranking, we are ranked in the third quartile. However, being one of the smaller mainland authorities, that's a ranking of 20 against where we are in terms of population size actually shows that we are better than our similar sized authorities. The challenge with that cost, It's the fixed costs of operating the council, and there is definitely an economy scale argument that comes to there. So we will always be, relative to large councils like Edinburgh or the Lanarkshires, the cost as a percentage of gross expenditure is likely to always be higher. But through the ISS review and other reviews, we'll look at continually driving that cost down. What I can't see is that will automatically result in an improvement in ranking. But I think in terms of where we are, in terms of size of council, our size, which is estimated being ranked 20th, is relatively better performance than you might have expected on size alone, if that makes sense.
Jim.
Hi, Gary, on page 27, 120, percentage of invoices sampled and paid within 30 days. We were at 95% on that, and we seem to be steadily decreasing to 90 in the last, over the year, or in the last quarter, I'm not quite sure. But we're heading in the wrong direction on that one. Was there particular reasons for that?
There's not particular reasons, and there's no nothing that would really justify that drop in performance. One thing that may factor in, as members will appreciate from previous discussions, we've introduced purchasing cards across a number of our sites. So some things are now out with the measure of PIs, and those were things that were probably paid quite promptly. Small value transactions, etc. So that might be having an impact. As the note says, one of the biggest factors in there is just making sure that our business processes and our managers are making sure that invoices are dealt with promptly, so that human interface in the process is just not causing unnecessarily delay. Certainly, as a management team, we have that on our list of things to have a report back, and we're expecting a report back to a management team and where we are and how we can get back to the 95% in terms of dealing with that drop in performance.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, Gary, thank you. We now move on to property and facility management. Gary Sherritt.
Thanks, Stuart. Similarly, I'll go through the front two pages and then take questions thereafter. In terms of the asset management rationalisation, they've been subject to quite a number of council reports in recent times. Obviously, the EWIM programme includes the office rationalisation first and foremost, and over the year we've seen the second floor Midlothian House and the conversion of Cross Street completed. That moves on to then the disposal of the assets that we've come out of, and part of that is looking at how we interface with our housing colleagues and other colleagues within the council to use those assets in the most beneficial way, and also bearing in mind that we are moving into the new realms where the Community Empowerment Act comes in, and that will have the opportunity for organisations which might meet the criteria to look at our assets for their own uses as well. Depot design and feasibility is touched on within the report there, but again, that's been subject to a council report in very recent history. Similarly, the Dalkeith Town Centre as well. Phase 2 housing, we have 127 houses completed in the Pennycook area, and we have a further 96 units ongoing, some of which have recently just been completed at Edgefield Road. Poulton Street's nearing completion, it's going towards completion, it's well under progress, and then the sites at Stob Hill are commencing at this point in time. New buyers' demolition process has been a long one. It's been a long one for legal reasons and scrutiny reasons, where the parties who we are taking writs against have had the opportunity to go and inspect the foundations and make their own conclusions as to what the findings are when the houses have been removed and the root cause of what the migration of the gas has been. We've not found anything that we didn't expect to see there, which has been good news from our point of view, and as such we've continued with our legal process to recover our losses, And whilst the report says we're moving towards writs being served on the three parties, we've actually gone past that now, and we're in the court process. So we have moved that on considerably. The potential sites for the remainder of Phase 2 and future Phase 3 sites are being assessed. And as I've just said, the sites that we've released through the office closures and the likes are being considered alongside other sites that we have at present time with our housing colleagues. In sport and leisure, one or two things to highlight here. The active living staff, we're discussing with the NHS staff, looking at the integrated team there, about how best we can use the preventative exercise as opposed to medication and the spend that goes alongside that. The free swimming that's come about since a council decision for that, we've had over 3,000 children use that initiative, and we've now extended that into the campus area in the PPP set up there. Scottish Rugby have latched on to the modern apprentice community coach that we've got in Amy Sanderson, and they're using her as a model for their own website, which is quite an accolade from our point of view. I think it shows the success that we've achieved in that area. The quality marks that we've achieved over the year just support the good work that's done in the club development field. And the introduction of Sport Hall Athletics by our active schools team has seen a considerable uptake of 427 pupils from 22 primary schools over the year. Carbon management, as has been touched on earlier, that's something that's still forefront of our minds. The CEF Fund, however, that supported that initiative ended in April. However, we negotiated with them, and the existing funds that we had, we were able to retain, and they're going to actually match fund those if we make sure that these go towards carbon reduction measures, and we've confirmed that we will do that. We're still working towards an energy company, and we've seen initiatives such as looking at solar farms, and indeed we're in discussions about the opportunities surrounding Shawfair and the residual energy that comes out of the waste plant that's there. We have considerable challenges coming forward from the increase in the nursery provision. I don't think that should be underestimated. Whilst we've obviously got pressure on the space and the capacity of the schooling or the buildings that we have there, we also have to look at the knock-on effect of having children throughout the day and the kitchen staff and the provision of potentially an awful lot more meals there. That's still to have some clarity put around it in terms of what we are to provide, but we're anticipating that that's coming. That's against a backdrop of absence and vacancy issues that we have within that particular service. If I can tell you that on a particular Monday, we had over 210 hours missing in one day. And given that the staff there only work a 2 to 3 hour shift, that's a huge percentage that we had difficulty with the absence in that particular day. Like others, we've been looking at initiatives to try and bolster our income, and we have secured a private cleaning contract with Melville Housing down at the Corn Exchange in Dalkeith, and we're looking to do the same with NHS Lothian for the combined premises at the new Paradikes building. Building services, against the backdrop of rising costs, we've managed to keep the projects that we're providing at this point in time within budget. But that is continually keeping we're continually having to work very hard at keeping costs down in terms of variations and making sure that contractors don't get ahead of themselves. We have managed to secure £157,000 of external funding for the continuation of the external wall insulation scheme, and also we've pursued Scottish Water for contributions of up to £500,000 for projects that are some years old now. Within property assets, the improvement plan for the ageing industrial estates continues, and we're working with colleagues within Ricky's area for landscaping and roads and external lighting and signage to try and improve these estates. The asset register has now been completed, albeit the detail has just been managed to make sure that is available and can be issued to coincide with the Community Empowerment Act coming into force. And finally, the new point-of-sale system that we have within Sport and Leisure that we're procuring towards the end of this year will allow us to more accurately look at the effect on footfall and income levels and the fees and charges changes that we have so that we can monitor and report on the effect of those. Pause at that. Thanks.
Thanks, Gary. Questions, comments? None. Gary, I have a few, sorry. The first one is probably, you touched on the Scottish Rugby Youth and Midlothian Sports Awards video and to highlight modern apprenticeships and their making base. You see it, I think last week high schools moved towards a school of rugby. The problem that many people see is, whilst it's okay to encourage that, there are very few publicly owned pitches for rugby to be played on. There are none in Bonnerig that are simply open to the public to book. There is now one at the Lasswade Centre, and I'll come back to how you book that, because that doesn't seem to be what the public were told when we built it. But I don't know of any rugby facilities in the Gorebridge area, and the Newton Grange area, and the Mayfield area, and the Bonnerig, Roslyn, Balsan. I think there are some in Pennycook, and there are some in Dalkeith. But apart from that, what other rugby facilities are out there? We're encouraging all these kids to take up rugby. How are we going to get them to actually, if we're successful, where are they going to go to play this rugby? Because you didn't have any pitches for them to actually play on. Now, the same could be said for football. It's a fantastic success to watch all these boys' clubs having all their accreditations and that, and they're growing bigger and bigger by the day. The problem that we're seeing all over the place is the pressure on pitches and stuff like that, training facilities and that for these youngsters to go to, and you now see waiting lists, I think, in Pennycook, Bonnerig, Newton Grange, I think even Dalkeith have now got waiting lists for to get into the boys' club. And that's no due to the fact that they didn't want to create the additional teams. It's having the actual facility to be able to handle these teams. How are you going to, keeping in mind we've just went through the local plan, one of the areas that was raised by Ian Johnson was under the last local plan, it was clearly identified by Leisure Services and Sport Scotland what was required to facilitate the additional houses that were coming in. That doesn't seem to have happened on this occasion. And I can clearly remember the earlier plans having exactly, including talking to cricket clubs, tennis, everything that was identified with Sport Scotland, has there been a shortage? There was also a land audit done between Sport and Leisure and Justin on what facilities would be required, what was there, what was underused, what was fully used and what was required, to evidence that the developers needed to contribute towards that. Now, that was used to lever in the all-weather pitches in Pennycook, it was used to lever in the new facilities at Polton Hall and some additional, but other areas got, like Gorebridge, didn't they do anything? Are you intending to now bring forward the report, taking Ian Johnson's statement to us that the time to do this is now, and to look at bringing forward at a later stage supplementary planning guidance of what's going to be required then? Have you started any of this work? Do you intend to start any of this work? And if you do, when do you intend reporting back to us? And I have a couple of more questions on that.
Sure. I mean, I think, first of all, we are a bit of a victim of our own success. The club development team have been putting together, or putting in an awful lot of effort to grow the clubs and make sure they're integrated and that we access sport for all if we possibly can. The lack of rugby pitches, we've actually only got three rugby teams within Midlothian, and Dalkeith, Pennycook and Lasswade. And you're right, there is a lack of rugby pitches, but we've looked at places in Rosewell, for example, very recently as to opening up potentially another pitch up that way. The hybrid posts that we have in place at Lasswade at this point in time on the third grass pitch there, we're looking to move them and put them into play in the Hopefield site. The old primary school there, there's a playing field at the side of it which could accommodate the pitch there, which would allow school rugby as opposed to more adult rugby. But yes, there is a lack of rugby pitches, and it's something that we probably have to consider. In terms of developing a strategy towards going back to Ian Johnson, I'll take that comment on board. I mean, I've obviously not heard what Ian said this morning, but I'll pick that up with him and come back. We have been looking at hybrid pitches and looking at the use of the existing pitches. Creating more pitches is one thing, but trying to use the pitches for longer periods throughout a season so that you can extend the lifespan of the playing surface is something that we have been looking into with Sports Scotland and others, including the SFA, to make sure that we get the maximum out of our assets as well. Obviously, the 3Gs and the artificial surfaces are one aspect, but the grass surfaces with the artificial surface through that allows that. I think it's something up to about 3 to 3.5 times as many games can be played throughout the season on that surface if it's made into a hybrid pitch. But I'll certainly take that up with Ian Johnson following your comments today.
I'm very much aware that through the local plan there has been a lot of discussion. I'm just wondering if members have any thoughts on how we bring this forward, because without having a properly audited land evaluation, as far as I'm aware, it will be very difficult to look at to ask developers to contribute towards something unless you can evidence that there is a shortage for it. Gary, are you intent to be doing a proper audit of what's there to give the credibility to the argument that the council will put to developers that they need to provide these facilities and they need to be available to the public?
I think what I'll do is I'll pick that up with Ian Johnson and find out exactly what he needs to make sure that that can be enforced. If that's a full land evaluation for sports use, then it's something I'll have to look at resourcing up if that is required.
Is it possible maybe even to bring back a one-page report to the next Performance Review and Scrutiny Committee telling us how we are going to do that? Because I think it's important if we're wanting to have these facilities at the end of this development plan, we need to be making sure that the work's going ahead. Jim?
Yeah, and I think the previous work that was done for the previous development plan, I think, looked at a whole Midlothian basis in terms of how many pitches were required. I think one of the problems we're running into now is there are certain areas with very, very little, and I'm talking about the Gold Ridge area in particular, where there's a lot more development going on, you know, a substantial amount of additional housing, additional people going there, but we didn't have the level of pitch facilities, surfaces, you know, artificial surfaces and things like that other communities have got. So it becomes more specific to individual communities rather than a Midlothian wide thing.
Yeah, I think certainly for the feedback I get, I think actually there's pressure, quite possibly because the areas in Gorebridge and that didn't have the facilities that just adds to pressure in the bigger places, including I've heard different groups in Pennycook saying, for example, they've had to go far afield to be able to book a facility because somebody else, for maybe Lowenhead or Bonnerig's, got the facilities already booked in front of them. So it would be handy to get that, Gary. If you could bring us back even a one-pager, just sort of saying what the timeline for that report and what it will include, what will be in the scope, what will be out the scope, to let us know what officers plan today to try and to manage this. It then probably brings me back to how are you going to, once new battles built, Gary? Certainly in Bonnerig, when we built last week, when the hub went in there were a lot of promises made to a lot of the sports clubs in that the facilities that were there were going to be available to them after sort of 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock. That sort of decision seems to have been reneged on now, and there's now this management committee or group or whatever that seem to be in control of these facilities. and there seems to be this ongoing battle with existing groups as to new groups as to who's getting them, and I'm not actually sure where the decision making is lying with that, because it looks like a deputy head teacher can walk into a room to me and say this is what's happening and that's the end of it. The people of Bonnyrigg made specific promises, and the groups and clubs in Bonnyrigg made these promises as well. We're taking away these facilities for you, you will have these. How do we resolve that in a fair way to these groups, Gary? And how do we make sure it doesn't happen when they build new battle?
I think that's a fair point. I think it's a point that I know yourself and I have discussed several times. I have taken that up directly with the new head teacher at Last Wade, for example, and we've had quite frank conversations about the use between the community and the school, and the fact that the school have an expanding role and an expanding curriculum is one thing, but we also have an expanding club development scene and a public use scene. So there's got to be that balance, and it's something that, let's say in the past, it's been more heavily influenced by one party, and I think we're seeing a redress of that balance, and I think a more level-headed approach towards the facilities and the use of the facilities. In New Battle, the head teacher is already engaged along the lines of what I've just described, that we have a more balanced approach towards the community use compared to just educational bias.
I've got to say it beggars the question as to who's in charge of this council. Is it a head teacher or is it this council? And I'm going to stress the point here that the head teacher at Last Wade was absolutely engaged. Albert Jastar was absolutely engaged, was straight down the line and was quite happy. The problem was, when the site opened, it wasn't Albert Jastar anymore, it was there. And when a new head teacher comes in, it's like, this is my world and the rest of the community is not getting into it. We're now in a position in Bonnyrigg where we were 5 years ago, where we have a part of this council block booking facilities and then no using them, and nobody else being able to get on them. A council losing an income, a facility that was built for our constituents, I'm going to say misused. And I'm going to just warn the members for New Battle, Gorebridge, Mayfield and all that, be careful here, because the promises that are made quite simply seem to evaporate. And we need to get back to the fact that we made promises to people and we should be honouring the pledges. Now, I understand there's pressure on the school to use the facilities, and I didn't have any problem. Where if the schools have the, or need the use of these facilities, then they should get the use of them. But there's nobody in this council at all should be able to say, well, I'm block booking that facility completely and then no bother using it, and everybody else take to it. I just think it's absolutely ironic that we're back at this. If they're actually working their way out of them not being able to do that. So I hope that we get that resolved, or it's something I will be looking for as a further report and for members to consider as to how we deal with these issues, because if what we're going to go down the line is all these schools that are going to have the facilities at them, it needs to be this council that controls how they get allocated and no one individual. Is there any other questions for Gary? Okay, thank you, Gary. Can we move now on to the Midlothian Council Quarter 4 report? Kenneth?
Thank you, Chair. This is the final report for the 2015-16, covering all four quarters. I mean, I'm aware that you've looked at quite a lot of the detail relating to this during the day, so I'll keep my introductory comments relatively brief. I suppose what I would say is I think there's much that's positive about this report. There's a lot of our services, I think, are performing at a good level, or a high level indeed in some cases, and I'll touch on some of the specifics. I think also what the report does is it points to the scale of some of the challenges ahead, and again, no doubt some of these have come up during the course of the day in terms of integration, in terms of new legislation, particularly in areas such as children's services and education. There's no sign of that diminishing. the ongoing need to transform services so that they're better for our customers and service users, and improving outcomes in key areas, and I mean both service areas and geographical areas. But the overwhelming challenge really remains a financial one. Everything that I see about the likely financial position in future years looks pretty tough, and it's not getting any easier. I think this council is in a relatively good position vis-a-vis its finances, but that could very quickly diminish unless there's pretty challenging decisions taken about where we provide services and how we provide them, you know, what services we focus on, and indeed that continued required investment in early intervention and prevention to reduce costs further down the line. So the front page summarises the overall position in terms of the Single Midlothian Plan, our priorities for 15-16, which of course have changed going into the new three-year period. Under the various Single Midlothian Plan themes, I'll just pick out a few items. I think that for all the challenges there are, our response as a council to the integration agenda has been very positive. I think the services round about Merritt and Hospital at Home particularly require or deserve some kind of recognition there. The position with Children's Services, it is the service which has been probably subject to most transformation and change over the last number of years. You can see some of the very positive inspection reports that are now coming out on the back of that process of change, and the work done in relation to, for example, the new family learning centres, the one in Woodburn opened in February of this year, and the very considerable drive there is about, you know, raising attainment and school performance is ongoing, and certainly the as I said previously, I think the pressure from Scottish Government in relation to attainment, and particularly attainment in our more deprived communities, will be unrelenting over the future period. The work on positive destinations, I think, also continues very positively. In relation to economic development, in the last year we have seen, as has been mentioned, the opening of Borders Rail. I think that there's some interesting messages that come out of that in terms of usage and the economic potential round about that. The fact that we've secured further funding for the LEADER programme, I think, is important. And I'd also, you know, we had quite a discussion there with Ricky about some of the challenges and issues around about waste. I think that there's some really important stuff being done there, not just in terms of the recycling, ongoing recycling work, but in terms of developments at Miller Hill, the food waste plant, the residual waste plant. Some of the potential there is very significant. And Gary spoke about phase two housing. I've touched on the challenges and the fact that I think the financial aspects remain the greatest ones. I think the implementation of the named person is one that's obviously got a lot of public attention, and that goes live in August of this year. A lot of detail in the report under each of the themes. Chair, happy to take any questions that members may have.
Does anybody have any questions for the Chief Exec? Keeping in mind the heads of service have all been here on most of them. Okay, can we agree to note the report? Can we now move on to the last two items, 4.5, the introduction of a balanced scorecard, Kenneth?
Yes, thank you, Chair. This report seeks to update members on the current position in terms of developing a balanced scorecard, and members may recall a training session we had, let's say, a number of months ago now, where we were looking with members about the range of performance information that we use within the council. We included the balanced scorecard as part of that. And you may recall from the previous annual reports we get from our external auditors, we're under some pressure, and there is an expectation that the balanced scorecard, which is seen as a more complete means of providing a picture of council performance, is something which is rolled out within the council. And we'd intend to do that only in relation to the council level reports, not the head of service level reports. In the context of the multi-agency single Midlothian plan, I suppose the purpose behind the balanced scorecard is really focusing in on, you know, the council's own performance in delivering against these shared priorities, but also some broader measures of how the council is performing in relation to its the financial aspects, HR-related aspects, and some of its internal processes. And so what we've done is we've developed a draft balanced scorecard for 15-16, really illustrative as much as anything, because you'll see there's quite a lot of blanks in the report, because really we're looking at a series of new indicators, many of which we'll use for the first time in 2016-17 as we roll this forward. So the appendix to the report sets out the proposed balanced scorecard. This would really, in the context of the council reports that come forward, would replace the PI section. And it shows on the first page a kind of an overall summary of what the balanced scorecard includes. It then goes on to specifically look at our key priority indicators. So for 15-16, these related to early years, economic growth, and positive destinations. Then there's a series of measures under each of the five community planning themes. Again, a relatively small number that we've selected in relation to each. And then the final three aspects of it cover financial performance, a section called learning and growth perspective, which is about, I suppose, staff and HR-related issues, also issues that relate to, for example, sickness, staff performance in relation to the annual performance appraisal, issues in relation to switch, and also what's coming out of the employee survey. And then the final section on internal processes covers risks, complaints, transformational change in the council's Delivering Excellence programme. So quite a lot of information there, Chair. It is meant to be of assistance and help to members in taking an overview of council performance. As I say, this particular report is illustrative because it will be fully populated when we go into the 2016-17 financial year. But if members have any comments about it, either about content or indeed about any of the details within it, I'd be happy to consider them at this stage, Chair.
Comments, questions? Are members happy with Jim?
It seems to me to be quite similar to, well, certainly the tabular stuff seems to be quite similar to what we have before. The inclusion of a graph at the beginning of each one that indicates, you know, how many we've got on target, off target, set is quite helpful. The only thing I would say there is that there's no inclusion or like anything that indicates progression. You know, you've got, I don't know if I'm meant to be as specific as this in the response to this, Kenneth, but you know, you've got 15-16 percentage target, you know, or achieved or whatever, but no indication of what the trend is. Mm. Is that, I don't know if that's a fair comment.
I think that is a fair comment, and that's certainly something which we could easily add to this report. I mean, I think with all of these things, it's a balance between trying to be reasonably comprehensive, not including too much information, but we could certainly incorporate some trend data into that. Of course, there will still be that trend data in all the head of service reports that are kind of summarised in this, but we can certainly look at that in terms of improving the final version of it.
Any other questions? I take it members are happy to approve this. Are members looking for any further training on understanding this new system or change system, or are you just quite happy that you have enough knowledge? Learning on the job. Okay, thanks, Kenneth. The last item is the procedures for the external inspection reports, Kenneth.
Yes, thank you, Chair. We brought this forward to the last meeting of this committee, and that had followed the request made by this committee at its meeting in January this year
to have a clear process for how we deal with external audit and inspection reports, because some of the discussion at that time showed that actually practice was a bit different in different parts of the council. So the report was considered at the previous meeting of this committee, and because at that stage it was a to-follow report, members asked that it be brought back for fuller consideration. But at that stage you also requested some changes to the report, particularly in relation to Appendix 1, which sets out the process. And you asked that what is now Paragraph 3 in Appendix 1 reflect your view that officers needed to ensure that relevant members, and particularly the portfolio member, were advised of any emerging areas of concern in advance of the publication of the report. So we have changed Appendix 1 to reflect that, and I think that appendix was the main focus of your concerns and scrutiny at the previous meeting. So the report has been updated to reflect that. This is the proposed process for how we deal with external scrutiny and inspection reports through both the Cabinet and PRS, and dealing with that in a robust way. And I'm happy to take any further questions or issues that members may have on that.
Thanks for that, Kenneth. I think Appendix 1 now reflects more accurately what we were looking for. Are members happy with what's been proposed here? I'll take that as a resounding yes. And thank you very much for your attendance. Provis, what time will we be commencing? 3:30. Thank you.